integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation. Welcome back to Military Justice. Thanks for being here again. It is 2018. I haven't been around for a while, and Military Justice has been on hiatus since late 2017. Hopefully this finds you all doing well. I think we've got a nice show for you today. It's kind of an interesting issue. We have a previous guest, Rob Bracknell, will be on the show, and we'll be talking about nuclear weapons and President Trump and orders he could give and how those would be executed. So I hope you enjoy, and I'm glad you are back for a new year.
Mission and a military function. And since the day I joined the service 36 years ago, every year I get trained in the law of armed conflict. And the law of armed conflict has certain principles. Necessity, distinction, proportionality, unnecessary suffering, all those things are defined. And we get, you know, for 20 years it was the William Calley Mealy thing that we were trained on. Because if you execute an unlawful order, you will go to jail. You could go to jail for the rest of your life. It applies to nuclear weapons, it applies to small arms, it applies to small unit tactics, it applies to everything, and we apply it as we go through it. It's not that difficult, and the way the process works, if you want to get into details later, I'll go into the details later, the way the process works is it's simple. I provide advice to the president, he'll tell me what to do, and if it's illegal, guess what's going to happen?
You say no.
I'm going to say, Mr. President, it's illegal, and guess what he's going to do? He's going to say, what would be legal? And we'll come up with options of a mix of capabilities to respond to whatever the situation is, and that's the way it works.
Butch, welcome to the show. Thanks for being on again.
Hello, Wyrick.
How are you today?
If that's your real name.
It is. Hey, for to make this a standalone show, even though you've been on a couple previous episodes, tell us a little about yourself.
Well, you know about me, but I know that maybe some of your new listeners may not. As you well know, you and I served together on active duty, where I spent 22 years retiring in 2014. I currently work for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization as an international and business law attorney. I used to be a tanker. I went to law school. I went back to law school again, and did some fun stuff. Went to Iraq twice, Afghanistan once, Bosnia once, Cuba a bunch of times. So that was kind of my career in a nutshell. Sort of my forte is international law. You know, I'm trying to expand my expertise all the time, but my advanced training is in high law. So, which is why I'm always interested in discussing international law issues with you, like the one that I think we're going to discuss today.
Absolutely. And to give a little bit of my background that'll be specific for this discussion, my last position on active duty was with the J7. I was an exercise legal planner, and we did all of the exercises for the various combatant commands. Now, Butch, I just want to get to just the part that we're going to talk about. We're listening to General Hayton. Military Justice, we were off for the Christmas break, and we're just coming back, but I think you and I probably had an hour-long discussion about maybe 15 minutes after that story broke on the news.
Which one? One of us texted the other one and said, dude, did you hear that?
Right, right. I think that was our instantaneous reaction. So to bring everybody up to speed, that was about 2 months ago at the Halifax International Law Conference, or our International Security Conference.
Halifax International Security Forum is a big, as the name implies, International Security Forum that they do every year up in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And most years, it's pretty well attended. It has been a who's who in the zoo with regard to international security issues.
Yeah, and that prompted us both to do this episode, and we're having, I believe it should be out by the time this episode drops, but we also co-authored a piece on task and purpose on this very issue, the issue of a combatant commander, who we just heard speak, say that if he was given the order for a nuclear strike by the president, that he would push back, I guess? I don't know. What's your take on what he's even saying?
God bless General Hayden, but there's so much craziness wrapped up into that interview. He's presuming that he's going to have time to have an extended colloquy with the president. He's presuming he's going to be able to clearly identify what's legal and not legal with regard to the use of nuclear weapons. He's presuming the president is going to give him a second to even push back at all when, as we've noted in our task and purpose piece that's coming out, all orders from a superior commander, even including the President of the United States. So when the President of the United States orders a commanding commander to do something, he is implicating military law. In other words, failure to execute the President's order in that case would be punishable under the UCMJ. That is what military authority means. That is one part of military authority, is that it can be punished for failing to obey. All orders of a senior are presumptively legal unless they are patently illegal. So unless the president's order is something that is patently illegal, obviously illegal, you have no luxury of questioning the order. And particularly with regard to the short response times when it comes to nuclear retaliation from a ballistic missile strike, I mean, we could be talking about less than 20 minutes. There may not be a whole lot of time for this. Mr. President, are you sure that's a legal order? Literally, they could be down to 3, 4, 5, 6 minutes of response time.
No, and just to
flabbergasted that he would say, I'm going to question the President of the United States, as though it would be so apparent as to what was legal or illegal. In order for him to question the order would have to be patently illegal. It would have to be something like, hey, General Hayden, it's the President. I want you to strike Ontario right now for no apparent reason whatsoever. And moreover, I don't want it to be a military target. I want it to be the center of gravity of Toronto. It would have to be something ridiculous like that for him to say, Mr. President, that's clearly illegal, and to have the legal authority to refuse the order. If there's anything else that has a colorable, if the president comes to him and says, General Hayden, and this, they don't do it verbally. There's a big, long, as you well know, there's a big set of protocols for issuing these orders. But if the protocols are followed and the launch order is issued, it's presumptively legal. There's not going to be a big time. There's not going to be time or availability for a colloquy.
Yeah, and going, especially focusing in on time, I mean, I was involved in exercises or war games for STRATCOM as a legal planner, and you're looking at, I mean, even at the max 45 minutes from detection till detonation. And
right.
And a lot less than that if it were for a sub off the East Coast. So
sure.
You're talking about 20 minutes to do this?
And you might be talking about less with a ballistic missile submarine, and if the target were Washington, D.C. I mean, you could possibly be talking about like 4 or 5 minutes of response time.
Right, and then also, this is the other part that I've kind of had a hard time getting my head around. When General Hayden says, well, I would tell the president about our other capabilities, as though, first of all, as though the president didn't know it, but also, that order coming to the combatant command is coming through and from SecDef, and with the, or at least the probable concurrence of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Pitney Bowes is the industry leader in mailing and shipping solutions. No matter what you send or how often, Pitney Bowes has the solution that precisely fits your needs. Weigh, print, mail, and save. You and your business will save time and money when you print postage and you won't need to wait in line at the post office anymore. You also won't need to worry about putting the correct amount of postage on your letter. On January 21st, USPS mailing and shipping costs went up, but you'll save 3 cents per letter with a Pitney Bowes solution. These discounts are not available at the post office, but you'll be able to beat the increase using Pitney Bowes. Whether you're sending a letter or package, you'll be paying less and saving money if you're using a Pitney Bowes storage solution. Plans start at just $5 per month. And for listeners of Military Justice, Pitney Bowes is offering a free trial, so you're sure to find the solution that's right for you. Visit pb.com/justice. Again, that's pb.com/justice. And learn more and get a free trial. Terms apply, and you'll need to see the site for details. But go to pb.com/justice. And we thank Pitney Bowes for sponsoring the podcast. And remember, you sponsoring our sponsors helps keep Military Justice moving along. Thank you.
There's not going to be any president to combatant commander colloquy. That was my point in the protocol. He's going to be transferred through the chain of command in a way. What does he think he's going to do is, you know, call the president up on the bat phone or something like that and say, hey, I know there's a Secretary of Defense and all that, but I really need to get this straight from you.
Or in the alternative, he's suggesting that he's going to say to Secretary Mattis, well, excuse me, Secretary Mattis, do you know about our other capabilities in the military? Like, as always, like, wait a second, conventional forces? Well, thank you. I haven't been in command of those for the last 40 years.
Yeah, I thought SOF was just on TV.
Right, and in that sense, he's going through two former Marine, or one current still, former Marine four stars, as though they're not going to know about the range of possibilities we have.
The whole colloquy is a little bit silly to me. This idea that he's going to have a more clear picture of what's lawful and not lawful, it comes back to me to this issue of presumptive lawfulness. The order is presumptively lawful and inappropriate to question unless, as unnerving as that may be, the fact that you might be getting an order to launch weapons, they're presumptively lawful unless you have, like, plain and apparent reason to believe that the order is unlawful. Like, it would have to be a crazy order to strike a non-adversary nation in its civilian populace in order for you to have a colorable argument that that's plainly not lawful. But if the order were, you know, execute whatever the code name is for the strike, execute a strike against North Korea, do it right now, that's so plainly presumptively lawful, I don't really know why we're even talking about second guessing it for its lawfulness or unlawfulness. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I would go a step further and say pretty much the only order you could receive that would be patently unlawful for this sort of strike would be a domestic strike. You know, if he said, okay, strike Boston.
Yeah. To strike London would be almost the same degree of presumptively unlawful, because you just can't think of a fact pattern where we would use nuclear weapons against allies like Canada or the United Kingdom. But you can think of a thousand scenarios where you might even have first strike authority to use against somebody like North Korea or maybe even Russia. It's not patently illegal for the president to say, I know something you don't know, and we're going to strike Russia right now. Because it's the presumption of lawfulness is a really strong concept. If there was not a presumption of lawfulness in military jurisprudence, I mean, military discipline really would fall to pieces, because you'd have, you know, everybody and their brother questioning every other order that they ever heard just because they didn't particularly agree with it.
Yeah.
You know, when the order is take Hill 781, you take Hill 781. It's presumptively lawful for you to take Hill 781. Unless, you know, and destroy everything on Hill 71 is a presumptively lawful order, unless there is a, you know, a orphanage sitting on the hill when you have zero evidence that that orphanage is being misused by the enemy or something like that. That would be a case where it's pretty apparently issued a unlawful order. But take Hill 781 is a presumptively lawful order. And in the history of all martial affairs since the beginning of time, it's always had to be that way.
Well, yeah,
that's why we train instant obedience to orders.
And I think the other problem you have with this, and it's kind of unnerving until you, when you really start thinking about the possible use of nukes. It's so difficult under our current paradigm for the lawfulness of war that you could even use nukes, because the idea of proportionality, it was so difficult to even fathom.
Yep. So for the purposes of looking at the analysis of whether, you know, the president's ordering the use of nuclear weapons is lawful or unlawful, quite frankly, we have to sort of disconnect ourselves from what we know about how terrible nuclear weapons are.
Right,
and
right.
For this purpose, they're just weapons. They're awful, destructive weapons. But for the purpose of analyzing whether the president has the authority to order and the general has the duty to execute, they're just weapons. They're not. They're terribly destructive weapons, but they're just weapons. There is no difference in the way weapons are looked at for that purpose. There could be a difference in the way, as you're noting, as the way that weapons are being are looked at with, in terms of proportionality and distinction and the cornerstone concepts on the law of armed conflict. So which leads me, which I think is what you're getting at here. There's only one court in the history of international courts. We really only have one data point on the lawfulness of the use of nuclear weapons. And I wrote a piece about a year ago about, does it even really matter? I mean, so if you get to the point where it's state-on-state nuclear exchange, lawfulness may have just gone out the window. It may not. So, okay, so it was unlawful. Well, there's not going to be anybody around left to adjudicate whether it was lawful or unlawful. And what if they are? What sanction would occur? But the International Court of Justice in 1996, I believe, issued an advisory opinion at the request of the United Nations General Assembly and the World Health Organization. Both of these bodies exercise their authority to ask the ICJ, which is also a UN body. They merged their query and asked whether the use of nuclear weapons is unlawful or not. And the ICJ, which is a court of international jurists, which sits in The Hague, went through a long and detailed analysis about whether, and they issued an advisory opinion. They're not actually deciding a case, but they're deciding a theoretical case by definition, because there hasn't been a use of nuclear weapon in armed conflict since 1945. And hopefully there never will be again. So they were looking at this hypothetical question and doing the analysis under international law as to whether the use of nuclear weapons could ever be lawful. And the most they were willing to do is they were unwilling to declare it unlawful. And one of the caveats was, when a state believes that its existence is, when it's facing an existential threat, they were unprepared to say that it was unlawful. They didn't go so far as to say the use of nuclear weapons is lawful. They were just unprepared to say that it was unlawful. But this issue of distinction, like you're talking about proportionality, any military target that a nuclear weapon, even a low-yield nuclear weapon, hits, even if it's a really, it isn't like if you drop a, you know, a 2,000-pound bomb on a command and control structure inside of Baghdad, will there be some civilian casualties? Yes. But will they be disproportionate to the military advantage gained? For example, we dropped on a building that we believed Saddam was in during OIF, in the early days of OIF. He wasn't there. The intelligence was stale. It was a little late. He had been there. And so the Schwachness building, there were a bunch of civilian casualties. But was that a lawful strike under the law of armed conflict? Yes, because of the importance of the target, because they did other things in order to limit the collateral effects. It is impossible to limit the collateral effects of a nuclear weapon. Like, what military target could you hit? And not, even if you parked one in the middle of the Pentagon and you destroyed the entire command and control system of the U.S. government, you're also going to kill 200,000-300,000 civilians around the Pentagon. I don't know how that's not per se disproportionate.
Yeah, especially if you look at the especially if you look at the Navy Marine Corps, because we tend to have such have coastal bases that if you have a strike at on 32nd Street in San Diego or at Camp Pendleton, that yield from that weapon is, you know, a couple hundred, 300,000-400,000 people.
Yeah.
And the
it's
same
really
for Norfolk.
Hard to get your head around a proportionality analysis when the effects from, you know, the ground zero of the weapon go so far and they're so devastating. It's just very different. And again, the ICJ was unwilling to come out and say it. It's just really, as you were talking about your experience with exercise planning, where you were going through this analysis that 20 ICBMs might be proportional, but 100 would be proportionate. Oh my God, what kind of macabre analysis? I mean, it's not even realistic to think about that, right?
And that was, those were the real actors actually doing it at that. Like, we were having that discussion. Those would be the people, you know, still currently at StratCom. And that's what we're talking about is,
yeah,
it, well, 20 or 100, but just the immense amount of destruction from one ICBM is really hard to wrap your mind around. And the idea, well, as long as we don't go over 20, we're fine.
That's crazy. The effects are so wide ranging, and so devastating on civilian population. I'm trying to think of a military target that is somewhere that would have no effects on the civilian population. I guess maybe if you were striking an Air Force base in,
right,
North Dakota, like that, you'd have pretty limited civilian effects. Don't tell the fine people of North Dakota that they're having a bad day. But relative to striking the Philadelphia Navy Yard or something like that, you're going to have a lot less civilian casualties. But it's just hard to get your head around a real legitimate proportionality analysis. Yet that's the only tool we have for measuring whether, you know, those are the only tools, is doing a conventional analysis using a super unconventional weapon. Like, the yields, they're so disproportionate. I shouldn't use that term. There's so much more lethal than a regular weapon, even a MOAB or something like that, a low yield nuclear weapon. Just it's orders of magnitude more destructive, and orders of magnitude greater impacts on the civilian population. No matter what, you're going to have disproportionate effects on civilians, no matter where the target is.
Which brings us back around to, so if General Hayton is saying that, okay, I might get an illegal order, I think that one of the only ways you could determine it's illegal, aside from, like you say, you know, launching on Montreal, is that it's disproportionate. So how's he going to go in that condensed cycle? How's he going to go through that determination about the, you know, the legality because of the proportionality or discrimination on a strike on North Korea?
And not just that, let's say that he could do that by his comments, by saying, Mr. President, that's illegal. He's basically elevating his opinion about legality above that of the president. That's a really dangerous concept. It's for the general to say, hey, you know, I'm going to push back on you real hard here. I mean, it's not like the president doesn't have a bunch of talented folks on his staffs, for example, the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice, and, you know, the Office of General Counsel at the Department of Defense and Department of State, and the White House Counsel's Office and the National Security Council. They've got a bunch of really talented people here who would have done their own analysis on this issue. But when he comes in and says, well, he's going to, Mr. President, you know, that's illegal. He, like, the tone of the comments is like, I'm sure you've never thought of this before, and it's never occurred to anyone here inside of Washington, D.C., but that could be illegal. They've already done that homework. In the time where the decision cycle for the National Command Authority has been spinning up to the point where the president believes that he's ready to launch weapons, they've already thought through this, and they've already gotten to the point where they believe we're making a determination that this is legal. It gets back to presumptive legality. Unless the order is patently unlawful, it is lawful to execute. And I mean, and when I was reading and listening to that clip, it was surreal to me. I mean, if I'm the president of the United States and I think I've got a limited amount of time and I really do believe I'm facing the existential threat and that I have to retaliate, I mean, as soon as he says, Mr. President, my next words out of my mouth are, you're fired. Get me the deputy commander right now. How about you? Will you issue the order? Well, Mr. President, you're fired. Now get me the operations officer. I mean, how, you know what I mean? There's just no time for this colloquy, and it's just senseless. It's senseless to say that he would be able to push back on the order in the amount of time that you have, and given our tradition that the orders of the commander-in-chief are presumptively lawful. Unless he were exhibiting some symptoms of dementia or some symptoms of that he wasn't thinking clearly, that the order being issued was not one that was being issued of sound mind or something like that. I guess then you'd probably have a defense to it. Man, I would not even want to be the one that had to try to make that a medical assessment with non-medical training in the moment where I have to decide whether to launch nuclear weapons to save California or not, you know?
Well, and then also the mechanics of it, you know, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, we bring in the football, which is that the briefcase carried by is usually a lieutenant colonel or a commander.
Usually it's 04s and 05s, I think.
Yeah, so the president carries they call it the biscuit, the actual card that has the codes in it, and then that goes into the football. And so, but when that commander, he already has to have, I mean, there's two-person authentication. So it's got to be the orders from the president and then the Secretary of Defense, or I think it can drop down to chairman of the Joint Chiefs if the secretary is not available. But both of those people have to give that order. So there's so the idea that, and for this exercise, let's pretend there was a different president, you know, that we were talking about, and you know, because I think occasionally some people might think that our current president might make some rash decisions, but this idea that the president alone is just going to, you know, wake up and just grab the phone and say, you know what, launch a nuclear strike. Yeah. It's already going to be vetted by the Secretary of Defense before it even gets to that combatant commander.
But let's be clear about what vetted means. The Secretary doesn't have to validate the president's order. He's just – the two-person authentication is just a safeguard against
– It's really against, just to make sure that it's the president on the line. It's just that he's saying line. It. Yeah.
Exactly. And that he's of sound mind and body, that he's not experiencing some sort of infirmity, or he's not under duress. He doesn't have a terrorist, you know, pointing a gun at his temple or something like that. That this is one of those reasonable steps to believe that the president has the capacity, the mental capacity to issue the order he's doing right now. But the legal authority is not questioned. The Secretary of Defense doesn't get a veto. This is what I meant earlier about a nuclear weapon is for this purpose, for the purposes of this analysis, it's like any other weapon. It's as though he said deploy a squad of Marines, or he said deploy a division of the Army, or he said conduct a conventional strike with an Air Force wing, and it just keeps going up. But all that is a continuum of lethality, of capability. And nuclear weapons are way out on the right end of that. But at the end of the day, it's on the same continuum. His legal authority to employ anything within the national military capability is his alone. It's in Article 2. The Commander-in-Chief clause obviously was drafted over 200 years ago when they didn't have nuclear weapons, but it means what it means. He is the Commander-in-Chief. It doesn't say Commander-in-Chief when validated by the Secretary of Defense. You know, you've heard this stuff, and I included it in our first draft, and it got cut out, about how the Congress has been talking about trying to draft legislation to put restrictions on the president's authority to employ nuclear weapons. I believe that would be plainly unconstitutional, plainly a plain intrusion on the president. It would be like the War Powers Act times 100. You know what I mean? I mean, the War Powers Act has been passed, has objected to the constitutionality of the War Powers Act. Okay. Now you're going to take the War Powers Act and you're going to multiply it by put it on steroids for nuclear weapons. And you think that the president wouldn't contest its constitutionality? He would run, not walk, to a court to get an injunction against that right away. And based on my knowledge of the jurisprudence, I think he'd probably win that one.
Going back to, I probably shouldn't have said vetted by the Secretary of Defense, what I'm saying is by the time it gets to the combatant commander, the Secretary of Defense is already, you know, in his role as the primary military advisor, already given his advice to the president before that phone call is ever made to the combatant commander. So I think that's what I was trying to get to, that like they've already made this decision, and ultimately it is only one person's decision. It is the president's, and he has advisors, absolutely. But this isn't – there's no other check on that.
That's right. There's no other check on that, and his orders are presumptively lawful. So we need to get our heads around the fact that I know that everybody thinks that, well, you know, we're not really sure about how it would work on this president's watch and so forth. The system doesn't contemplate that kind of consideration. The system says this is the result of the election, is that you put this enormous, unreviewable, lethal capability in the hands of that guy. So be careful how you vote. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
It doesn't change whether it's George Bush, you know, whether it's 41 with his extensive war record, and I think pretty, you know, well regarded as a pretty trustworthy guy on issues of national security, or whether it's 42, a guy who was a Rhodes Scholar and is probably pretty competent in the field of international relations because he's a really bright guy, or whether it's 43, a guy who, while you know he had detractors about his mental capacity and things like that, again, 43 was pretty trusted. He was trusted by the American people. People believed that he had good judgment. Or whether it was 44, again, another really smart, capable, serious guy. But it doesn't matter now that we think that, you know, some people believe that you've gone to 45 and this fundamentally changes everything. No, it doesn't fundamentally change anything. The framework is the framework. And
right.
The president has that unreviewable Article II authority to employ these and to issue presumptively valid military orders to use nuclear weapons. That is scary that much authority is vested in one person. And that all it's binary for him. He can flip the switch and it's on.
Well, and as you mentioned that, the any encroachment on the president's power, if you look back to just the last administration, that administration didn't care much for the War Powers Act. I mean, our launch against Libya, when we went over the 90-day mark of the War Powers
exactly.
Act, didn't exactly. we say that it wasn't we came out with the determination that it wasn't an armed conflict?
Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't hostilities?
The twisted logic of that one, even though there were combat squadrons launching ordnance against targets on the ground, yes, that was the tortured logic for why the War Powers Act didn't apply in that case.
Well, and if somebody was doing that to us, we'd probably consider it fairly hostile. Like, wait, why are you guys dropping bombs on us?
Yeah, well. This is not a partisan issue. This isn't a Republican issue or Democrat issue. It's an executive and legislative
right.
issue. It's a separation of powers issue, and it always has been a separation of powers issue. And every president, no matter what power, and no matter whether his party was in power in the Congress or not, every president has objected to the restrictions that were imposed by the War Powers Resolution.
Yeah, the only reason I disagree with you a bit about Congress taking any action on this, Congress
yeah.
has been more than happy to sit on its hands. Is it our authorization for the use of military force old enough to drive
yeah.
now?
Yeah, yeah. So right, and that's a podcast that you and I have been talking about trying to get on, and that's a separate topic and a fascinating topic in its own. I did. So let me be more clear. I don't believe Congress will actually pass any legislation, but there's at least been one bill that's been introduced. It'll never get out of committee, but at least there's some congressmen that are making noise, and maybe 25 years from now, when the stars align and both the president is one party and both houses are dominated by the other party, maybe it'll get some traction that they can get past a veto-proof majority vote there. But don't get me wrong. I don't think there's any danger there's any real legislation that's actually going to pass, but at least people are talking about the need for legislation to make sure that it isn't a one-man decision. And I don't believe that such legislation would pass constitutional muster.
Right. Absolutely. And nor should it. I don't
Article
know how says, else you yeah. would do this.
Yeah. It's impractical to a certain and to even believe that you could impose those by the nature of the employment of that tool and the timelines that are required, it's impractical to believe that you could introduce other actors that aren't in the executive branch into the, even if the legislation said something like, with the concurrence of the Secretary of Defense or something like that, it's really violative of the principle of unity of command. I mean, command is supposed to go, it isn't supposed to be shared between people. It's supposed to go in a linear relationship straight down. This guy's your boss and you're responsive to his orders. And then that guy is somebody else's boss and he's responsive to his orders. And that guy's somebody else's boss and he's responsive to his orders. I'm using my pronouns for convenience.
Right. So any thoughts on the general's motivation for doing this?
I mean, I think he's, you know, he's a human being. He understands how much sensitivity is out there about how nervous people are about the possibility of, I mean, honestly, we're probably closer to a nuclear confrontation now than we have been maybe since, you know, 1960 or that. We are probably closer than we've been in an awful, awful long time. So, you know, he's probably sensitive to the fact that people are nervous about it. He wants to reassure people about that it isn't just going to be some willy-nilly decision. And the fact of the matter is, he doesn't get a vote. You know, he's the executor there. He's the guy who's supposed to go out and execute the order. He doesn't get a vote in the policy about whether to employ nuclear weapons. He's the how guy, not the weather guy. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right. He is a large switch. I mean,
exactly. He is a switch.
He keeps everyone maintained and keeps the facility ready to execute that order.
Right. And God bless him for doing that. I'm sure he's very, very good at it. But this whole thing where he strayed out and sort of suggested that what he is really suggesting is that the president's authority to use nuclear weapons isn't quite as absolute as we might believe. And that's just categorically untrue. You know, I think he was trying to reassure some of our allies and some of the partners in the international security arena. People are really nervous about this whole thing, but nervous or not nervous, the fact of the matter is the president enjoys that authority. And so be careful who you give it to. If you're nervous that the guy who's got it right now, if that makes you nervous, make that a factor in how you make your electoral choices, because that's a really big part of the presidency. It may be the most important part of the presidency, right?
Oh, absolutely. In preparing for the recording this, and while I was, someone was asking me about the piece we're writing for Task and Purpose, I think on the bad side, as far as readership and listenership, there's probably about 20 of us that really care about this and are getting all worked up, because it's, and fortunately, it's a fairly hypothetical situation.
Yeah.
You know, that,
God,
you know,
God willing.
Right. So hopefully we'll never know really if the general would have done that or not. But I still think, and I really appreciate you coming on here and us writing that together, because I think it still is important to talk about that, the idea of having four-star generals just out there flippantly saying that, you know, I'm not sure that I would obey the president is not
maybe
good.
Maybe I would, maybe I wouldn't. We'd certainly have a talk about that one. I mean, that's really honestly how it came across to me, as opposed to saying I would obey the orders of the president and I would assume that he had done his due diligence in deciding. You know, you have to assume that the president has done his job. You have to assume that he has that authority for a reason. Our whole system kind of relies on a presumption that those orders are valid. And if they're not, then that the system would have taken care of that in some way. I know I may be living in kind of an idealistic la-la land about that, but I don't know how I think the system comes crumbling down if four-star generals believe that they have some sort of license and some authority from somewhere that I can't really find the root of the authority to question the president's. If he's surfacing an issue for discussion, that's one thing, but if we're in an in-extremis situation where you've got a certain number of minutes to respond, and he's talking about having a discussion with him then, hey, you missed the chance. You should have gotten on the president's briefing calendar 3 weeks ago or something, you know? We're past that.
Right. I think the last time we really had that was during the Korean conflict, where we had a general kind of outstripping his authority.
Yeah, right. Yeah, anyway. And so let me be clear. I'm not making any – I take no public position here about the president's fitness to make a decision about nuclear weapons or not to make a decision. My observations about this were basically predicated on people's nervousness about it and things that are being, you know, you read, you can't open up any media outlet right now and talking about without hearing, reading something about people's concern about fitness for office and things like that. I take no position on that. My position is the president of the United States, as so long as he's functioning within his obvious mental faculties, in other words, in that he looks lucid, he doesn't look under duress, he doesn't look intoxicated, he doesn't look like he's experiencing some sort of medical emergency, and he issues an order, it is a presumptively valid order, even if the consequences of that order are almost unthinkable.
Right. I'm of the exact same position, that this episode and our article It's the same if we would have done this 20 years ago or 20 years into the future. We're just talking about that position, and that position always has that authority.
Individual executing the framework. And when Joe Hyten came out, I think that he was taking into account the, you know, a lot of other factors. And he's in a tough position, don't get me wrong, because there's a lot of uncertainty about that out there. I don't have to take a position on whether the uncertainty is wise or unwise to observe that there is more uncertainty right now than there has been in the past, I don't know, 20 years or 30 years or something like that. Wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. And well, one final thing. Did you ever see the president's button? Is it bigger than the North Korean leader's button? Isn't that?
It's funny you say that. There's a piece in our article that we're writing there where I'm talking about the button. People talk about the button like it's a real button. Right. But the button, it is really nothing more. That's like a shorthand for authority and capability wrapped into one. It's like, you know, the easy from that office supply store that you just hit the easy button. There is no button where you can reach over and touch the button and all of a sudden the missile Bombay doors open up and they start launching or something like that. The button is a shorthand for the summary of his authority and the capabilities all in one, and the command and control structure that he can initiate in order to cause nuclear weapons to be employed against an adversary. The size of the button, I'm not sure. Because it's theoretical to me, I refuse to indulge those questions about size.
Right. And the idea that it's this overly sized cartoonish red plunger, you know, that Wile E. Coyote's about to push down.
No, exactly. It says Acme on it.
So I'll put your previous piece, and of course I'll put our task and purpose piece down in the show notes. Where else can listeners follow you?
At Butch Bracknell, although you're always you're kicking my butt all the time about how bad I am with Twitter, and I keep promising you I'm going to get better with it, but I do need to restart it. And I also have a Weebly website. It's Butch Bracknell. If you Google Butch Bracknell Weebly, Weebly, Weebly is just a hosting site, and I have a page out there where a lot of things that I've written are collected, including a couple pieces that you and I have written together.
Well, thank you again. Can't thank you enough for being on, and it was a pleasure to co-author that piece with you.
Broham, I miss you. Come and visit.
Military Justice is a production of Long Arc Digital Media. There are numerous people that need to be thanked for making Military Justice possible. First of all, audio. Those are the people that clean up all the mistakes I made. Hannah McCarthy, she takes care of that. Methil Talhan, she takes care of everything. And as always, Uber producer Dreadnought has my six.